Bushman and Cutler. Lindsay Cutler was her father was W.S. Cutler, the brokers, Gresham House. And Cutler's father died. And Lindsay Cutler told Charlie Smith that he would like to take over his father's firm and leave with goodwill. And Charlie agreed, and Morris Smith was with Burge and Gosjork. And Charlie said, what about it? And he said, yes. And then came Smith Brothers. And Morris Smith was the gold mining dealer. And that was, I think it was 1936, and they started up then. And that's when Davis went over and became his boy, as I told you. And then Marks followed. Michael Marks, you know, at the moment, that's Henry's nephew. Now, he came in the firm when he was just a kid as well.
So how would you describe the firm just before the war started? Was it still very similar to the firm that you had joined?
Yes, very similar. Didn't change the style at all.
And were you still an authorised dealer?
Yes, I was an authorised dealer. I told you I became an authorised dealer in 1934. I was 24, wasn't I? Yes, I came in 34. And
you'd always stood with Charlie Smith in the industry?
Never anybody else.
And how did the relationship work? Were there other people working on that book with you?
Not at the time, no. There was Carl, who ran a small book on his own. He wasn't a very good jobber. And he eventually went out. And there was just Charlie and I.
Do you have a blue button with you?
After I gave it up, yes. I had a blue button with us, yeah.
And were you dealing in the same stocks that Charlie Smith was dealing in, or did you have your own separate stocks?
No, he dealt in the Courtaulds and British Celanese, all the textile stocks. No, I did Dunlop Chemical and Boots, and I elaborated out into the iron mine things. And after the war finished, Ranson and I came back, and we had a head-to-head to say what we're going to deal in, because most of the old stocks we dealt in were either gone or weren't worth dealing in. So he took up the leisure groups, Billy Butlins, Warners, Pontins, Mecca, all the leisure groups, where the money, pent up money during the war was coming out. I took up all the dog shares, GRA, Wembley, Hackney, Southend, Clapton, Walthamstow, all the dog shares. And I had queues formed in to buy and sell stocks. There were queues every morning on my pitch when I got there at 9:30. There were at least 20 or 30 brokers. And when I started in GRA, they were a shilling a share. And they went from shilling to 25 shillings a share. And I made a small fortune out of it, jobbing competitively. You couldn't believe it. I mean, they didn't want to know anything about ICI and Dunlop. It was all the leisure, but pent up money during the war, coming out. And the fortunes were made in these small leisures and dog shares, until in the end they evaporated. I think about 2 or 3 years after that, they're still dealing them, but you know, most of them merged. And I mean, I used to go to lunches with Billy Butlin and Pontin, with a firm called Jenkins. I heard of them. Sid Jenkins was a great pal of mine. He died recently, and him and I used to go with Pontin. Fred and Billy Butlin up at Connaught Rooms at Liverpool Street. Every year for luncheon up there. And we used to market all their stocks.
And what was the idea? It was to keep friendly relations with the jobbers and make sure that they knew enough about the firms that they were trading in.
Yes, we knew how they used to tell us what they're doing and what have you, and helped and everything like that. We had, an affinity that we market their shares, and they helped us with their knowledge.
Do you think jobbers generally had much contact with the companies in whose stocks they traded?
No. Only in certain specialised things like I mentioned. No.
Were those relationships important for particular stocks?
Yes, very helpful.
In what ways?
Because you could pass, I wouldn't say you pass all the information on, but you pass a certain amount of information on to other people, the other brokers to their clients, letting them know how the business were getting on. Because, I mean, as I say, after the war, they were very specialised stocks, because they were pent-up stocks where money was going into leisure, where people have been for 6 years have been without leisure and couldn't spend their money or couldn't do anything about it.
What had you done during the war? Had you been with the forces?
Well, I joined up and I was called up. I volunteered for the HAC. They had a waiting list. We all did in the Stock Exchange, volunteered for it, couldn't get in. So I was called up in the Royal Engineers at Andover in 1940. Did my training there. Very hard training as well, tough. They weren't ready for us, hadn't got any guns, hadn't got anything, you know. Slept on a mattress of straw. Real tough, coming out, I mean, you know, your good life into the bad life. You didn't know where to hit you. Anyway, I did my training, and then being the engineers, and being, D-Day was coming up, I spent a year in Scotland training in Moray Firth, where we trained to land on the beaches there, timing, what time it took to convey the ships from the liners onto the beaches. As I say, we spent a year there on doing that, and then we brought us down south to Cosham, where we formed up as a unit. And we got on the boats at Cosham, Gosport on the afternoon, and we laid off at Ryde Pier that night to go to Normandy. And the weather forecast came over, it was bad. So for that night we spent on board. And the next morning we set sail, and in the next evening we set sail, and the next morning, about 8 o'clock in the morning, we landed on the beach of Normandy, on Sword Beach. We lost a third of our company on the first day, mines. I was a lucky one. And we were supposed to take Caen the first day, which we didn't. The infantry couldn't get in. We were backing them, they couldn't get in. We were thrown back on the beaches. I thought we were going to be thrown back to England, but we weren't. We muddled our way through. It was a muddle. We had hardly any rations, compo rations. We were being shelled by right and left from everywhere, because he brought up a couple of Panzer groups. Anyway, cut a long story short, Eisenhower got us and American troops through what they called the Falaise Gap. We went through the Falaise Gap round the back of Jerry, round the back of Caen, and 2 days after that, we crossed the River Seine under fire again at Rouen. And then we steadily made our way through Belgium, Holland and Belgium. It took a long while because before we went abroad, we did our bridging, Bailey bridging, which we became very expert on, up on the River Irvine at Kilmarnock in Scotland. And the Bailey bridging consisted of pushing pontoons out and building the bridges as you went out on the pontoons across the rivers. Very clever. He got a knighthood, Mr. Bailey. He lived in West Byfleet. We knew him, didn't we? That's that part. Then I got stranded up when they came through the Ardennes. They got stranded up in the north of Holland for quite a while, over one Christmas when it snowed. And then we eventually crossed the Rhine under fire again on pontoons and Bailey bridges, across the Rhine at Wesel. And then I went through the Ruhr, right through to Lüneburg, where the armistice was formed. And I was stuck in Hanover, and I wasn't demobbed because I was 9 months occupation troops, looking after the German hospitals and keeping the Poles from fighting the Germans. And I got demobbed in Group 26 at Olympia in 1945.
And did you always assume that you would be returning to the Stock Exchange after the war?
Yeah, I knew the job was open.
And how had the firm managed during the war?
Bad. Hardly made any money at all. Hardly made any money at all. As I say, directly we came back, we flourished. We went from strength to strength.
When you did return, did you make any plans for the firm, and how would you wanted it to develop?
Well, I came back, and I think I told you, I had a powwow with Mr. Ranson, you know, who was a partner at the time, and he said, well, look, Archie, he said, the money's going to be in leisure, and he was right. He was a very clever man. So he said, I'm going to do leisure camps, holiday camps, what have you. And he said, what about the dog shares? I knew nothing about them at all. So I said, well, good idea. So I put my head down, got them figured all out, and started on that.
Do you have any memories about what the stock exchange was like after the war? Were there a lot of people returning? Were there a lot of old members about?
Yes, I think I would say 90% of the people who left came back. Certain people were killed. I would say 80 to 90% of the people who had the continuity going came back, yes. Mostly in their same firms.
Was there much business going on?
Yes, it developed very quickly. Very, very quickly, and there was a big turnover.
And how did you find settling back in after being on active service for such
a
long time?
I loved it. Once you were making money, you loved it. I'm not being rude, but... it was there, you know. Having had 5 years on practically no money at all, to get back making money, I mean, was a great thrill.
Where were you living at the time?
Ilford, Essex. Renting a house, 27 and six a week. 3-bedroom house, which I eventually bought for £1,900. And then I sold that and bought the house in West Byfleet for £5,500, which I thought was a fortune, which I sold for £35,000, and which now goes about £250,000 now. That's money.
Did you become a partner of this? Did you become a member of the stock exchange about this time?
1946, yeah, it was 1973.
And did that involve anything in particular? Did it improve your status?
Oh, yes, become a member of Stock Exchange. You have to have a couple of guarantees, you know, sureties, they call them. And yes, that did. It put your status up. Then I became a partner.
And when roughly was partnership?
Yeah, I became a partner in 1950, that's right.
And. What did partnership involve? Did you have more responsibility in the firm?
Oh, yes. Well, you had to have a meeting every week to resolve matters and business and money and everything like that.
Strategically,
yes. And took after the office staff as well. I mean, we were carrying a bigger staff after the war. And we got bigger and bigger. I became a partner, then Sidney Davis became a partner, and then Henry Mart became a partner. I was the first of the three. There was only a year between the three of us in the 80s grade group. And we were very good friends, I mean, wives, and got a lot of get-togethers. We had a very good affinity, the whole firm built up on goodwill.
Now, did you stay in the same markets that you'd originally been trading in?
Yes, never moved. Never moved till I retired. Always in the industrial market.
Now, was there anything distinctive about the industrial market compared with the other markets in which the firm was trading? Were they similar markets or were they very different?
Well, they were similar. They were very similar markets, dealt on the same basis of price making, buy and sell all the time. No, it was the same principle, the whole thing, except there were different shares and different names. Mm. The industrial market was about 5 times as big as the mining market. Industrial market was considered. There was the gilt market, which was very specialised again. Had a lot of jobbers there. Must have been 15 to 20 jobbers in the gilt market one time. Small, 5 big jobbers and 15 small jobbers. But that was very specialised, and you never found an industrial jobber going into the gilt market. They were built through the years, you know.
And were there still many jobbers dealing in the industrial market? Oh, if we look through the 50s,
yes,
and 60s.
In the industrial market, there could have been about 50 to 60 jobbers, jobbing firms, 50 or 60.
And did you feel you were directly competing with each other, or again, did you only regard
no,
a smaller group of
the competition was fierce. The competition was fierce. Even among the bigger jobbers, the competition was fierce. The smaller jobbers mostly undid their job business with the bigger jobbers. If they couldn't do it themselves, if they couldn't finance it or do it themselves, it came to the small, the bigger jobbers and undid it with them. And they were allowed to do it. But you couldn't go to a small job and undo your business. He wouldn't take you on because he thought you knew more than he did.
Were you still being used as a source of information about the stocks?
Oh, yes.
Did that continue right through?
Right through.
Even up to the early 70s?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And did you still have much contact with the brokers who were dealing with the country jobbers?
Yes. That did go down. The country country business went down quite a lot. Because I think they could, more or less, with bigger money around, they could do the business up there instead of shunting it downstairs to London. So if that the shunting business fell, the Beckerson and Blunt and Marshall business, that depreciated.
And did the the actual firm have any plans to expand? Because you think about the 50s as a time when firms like Aykroyd's and Durlacher's began, and Pynchon began to
We took on a rubber firm, which was Dickinson and Duncombe, who found that they couldn't cope with the business because they hadn't got the capital. So we took them in. We took over their business, became rubber dealers, and we're still on the rubber market. And eventually we took over Sanborn, which was a fairly big, not as big as we were, but a fairly big jobbing firm. We took them over. The senior partner wanted to retire. The rest of the firm couldn't keep the continuity going because they hadn't got the capital. So they became involved with us, and we took over two of their partners joined the firm. One of them's still a partner now.
Were they fairly easy mergers to organise?
Oh, yes.
Did the people fit in?
Yes.
Fairly well with
yes.
each other?
Yes, no trouble. No trouble, easy. It just meant them closing up their offices and coming in with us as firms. Yeah.
Were you as a firm also expanding, increasing in size?
We were only expanding in our own rights. We didn't, except those two firms, we never expanded anywhere else. We took those two firms in because we thought they were going to be, we were going to make money out of them, which we did. But other than that, no. We only expanded in partnerships, taking in extra partners in our own firm. We became a big firm with 15 to 20 partners.
I wonder if you could describe what a typical day would have been like for you sometime.
Well, I got up the office in the morning. I got up the office in the morning about 9 o'clock.
Would you be reading the newspaper?
Read the newspaper, having a confab with the rest of the partners or dealers and get their opinions of what they thought the market was going to be. And we generally conclude with certain things that, you know, some of us didn't agree with each other and some thought the market would be better or easier. But we used to go downstairs, and then when we got downstairs, you could soon find out which way the markets go, because the brokers would be coming around trying to execute their orders. And you could soon find out whether there was a larger proportion of buyers or sellers. And from there, you worked the way, and the day went on just normally, all day jobbing. And the stock exchange in the old days used to close at 3 o'clock, and we'd be up the office, and we'd start up there till about 5 or 5:30 in the evening, dealing on the phone.
How would you know what prices to quote, and how would you decide to vary your prices?
On the buying and the selling. You either lower, if there's a lot of sellers about, you lower your price if you found a market, where the buyers will take it off of you, or the other way around, if you reach a higher price where you get sellers coming in, and you execute the business that way. It depended on the buyers and sellers during the day, you know, the numbers, you know.
Did you feel that you were seeing most of the business that was about in the particular stocks
I would
that you were
say
trading
we,
in?
I would say, being Smith Brothers, we would see at least 60 or 70% of the business knocking about during the day. Yes, yes. We were one of the biggest. And we take on anybody. All right, if you lost money on certain things, you didn't moan about it. They'd come back and help you the next day, probably. But we took on nearly everything.
And did you... Did you take on whatever size?
Within reason. If it was an amount which you weren't normal, you know, like I say, 100,000 shares, which in those days was quite a lot, you would go around to the rest of your firm and say, look, I'm taking on a big deal. you tell your other partners to, so that you weren't all doing the same thing. So you tell the other partners you've taken a very big deal until you undid it or executed the business. Just keep your powder dry. Mm. Otherwise, if you're all doing the same thing, you've been in the dirt. Mm. So you had to be careful on your big orders to let the rest of the firm know what was happening.
Mm. Was capital ever a problem?
No, it wasn't. As I say, Barclays were very good to us. It was never a problem. Not unless we used to let Barclays know every night how we stood. So there was no way that we were doing the wrong to Barclays, no way that they didn't know what was going on in our firm. We let them, our manager used to let them know every night our position.
What kind of capital did you think you needed to run your book? Again, approximately.
To run the firm or run the book?
To run the particular book.
To run my book of the night, I used to start, say, about £10,000, which is a lot of money to start with, which eventually went to 20, 30, 40, 50,000. Mm. The more money we made, the more money we allowed to use on the capital. The capital was going around all the time. Mm. The capital market used quite a lot of money. But other than that, no, because we were only industrial market in the capital, in the other markets.
Did you find that the institutions were beginning to make an impact on your business in the sense of the size of bargains that the brokers were asking you to do?
Yes, the number of shares they were dealing in used to creep up every year. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the old days, I mean, I'd make a price in 5,000 shares without hesitation. But eventually, it became 10,000 shares, mm-hmm. then 20,000 shares. But to take on 50,000, then you were going beyond your means. But up to 20,000 shares, you could always make a market in, yes.
Did that ever create difficulties for you? Did you begin to be conscious of that as a problem or as
It wasn't a problem, but it was something you had to fulfil. You had to knuckle down and say, I'll take a chance. Mm. And some of it was chancing, what you call chancing your arm, because 20,000 shares, stock like chemicals, which is about, standing, say, 2 or 3 pounds a share, was £60,000 of money, see? So you were taking a bit of a chance on that.
Do you remember any particular occasions when you felt that
you were
taking a chance or you'd overdone it?
Yes, and take a loss as well. Mm. So if you saw it was going wrong, the first job as principal was cut a loss. Mm. Don't sit and look at it, cut a loss, because you're wrong. Mm.
Can you describe any of those occasions?
Not untoward of what I've told you, no. If you knew, the job they called had a smell of the market, what it was doing, whether it was going better or easier. You had a smell, it's an uncanny expression to say, but you realise that sometimes you put your foot in it and you're taking something which you've got to get rid of. Mm. So if you could, you cut your loss. Mm. No, it was what they call a jobber's smell. Funny. Place to say, but you could feel you were wrong or right.
Did you find yourself beginning to take larger positions that you would carry over? Mm. Was this something that you worried about, or was it part of
there were times. At times, I used to go home at night and worry, have a few sleepless nights, and I'd take them probably more than I could chew. But sometimes it came out right, and sometimes it didn't. But you could never tell over one day, really. It was an overlap of a day or 2 days before you could undo the business. Mm. Sometimes you'd have to sit on it and just hope for the best and hope that somebody out of the blue would come and take your shares or sell you the shares you want. Quite often, I sold shares, which I hadn't got. Mm. You had to. If you're making a price, the broker would buy the shares and then the next broker would buy some more and you were really up against it. So you had to up your price to get the shares back. So sometimes you up your price to you cutting the shares, which you've already sold. That was a jobber's prerogative.
Do you remember any of those occasions when you'd sold yourself?
Oh yes, I often remember I sold, say, 20 or 30,000 ICI, and the next morning two or three other brokers come in on the same, probably the same order you had the night before, on somebody else's backs, because they wouldn't go back to the same broker, because they knew he wouldn't be able to do it. So they go to another broker, which was quite rightly done, but round the corner kind of business.
You mean the same client would
go to another broker? because he knew if he went back to the first broker who you dealt with, he wouldn't do his business. So he went back to another broker or two brokers, and they may not come back to you even. They may have gone to another jobber. But I mean, I wasn't the only dealer in ICO or those big leaders. I mean, there were other jobbers. So we were all looking at each other, all trying to find the shares to place against the order that was placed before.
Is that something that happened relatively frequently? A client would send several brokers into the market.
It wasn't looked upon as very nice. If he was found out, he was in trouble. Not in trouble. I mean, he was all right to do his business, but he was in trouble next time he wanted to do anything like that. The thing that you couldn't execute or bring off two or three times in a week or something like that. You might do it once a month. But.
Did you ever find cases where you had to go joint book with another jobbing firm to handle
them? Yes.
Can you describe what would happen in those circumstances? What would cause it to come about?
Well, if you had an affinity like I did with Sanborn, I knew Tom Luce and Gore very well. Sometimes I would get an order, say 10 or 20,000 chemical, and he'd open the same stock. And I'd go and say, Tom, I've got an order here. I'd open up to him, knowing full well that if he didn't take me on, he wouldn't let on. And quite often he said, yes, we'll go joint. We used to go what we called a joint account. Either him or I would finish the business off. But if he could help by selling me 10,000 or 5,000 every now and again, he would do. And in the end, after a day or two, you'd add up what you've made or lost and say, look, Tom, I credit you £25 or £50 joint to what we've made.
Would you ever go joint book before the war? Was that a fairly common? Well, not common. Was it something that jobbers
always did? Common on a small
did?
Scale. Common on a smaller scale, but after the war it got bigger. Very much bigger. But in the last 5 or 10 years, no, it fell through. Because I think every jobber now had his corn and didn't need the money to. He could stand his own corn and he didn't need to go joint.
Did you ever find yourself involved in takeover situations? Where a stock in which trading was being taken over, or a broker came to you because he wanted to accumulate a stake.
Before the war, there were very few takeovers. It all happened after the war. Long after the war. Takeovers didn't come on hand until about 1960, when firms then started taking over each other. Not stock exchange firms, but firms outside, like Cordals and Spann and whatever, took over. British Salonese and all that stuff. No, it was those kind of firms took over. But takeovers weren't apparent in those days, not till about 1960s, 70s.
Well, how would a jobber be? What would the jobber's role be in a takeover situation? Was it an opportunity for the jobber to turn over a lot of stock and if he had his book right to make a lot of money?
No.
Or were the jobbers generally?
Jobbers never heard about it. It was taken over. Very seldom, it was kept very quiet. Well, there was a leak here and there occasionally, but not very often. So the jobbers didn't know, and they saw it in the papers.
So did you often find that your book was wrong?
Yes, you could be quite wrong.
Well, what would you do then when you found yourself in that kind of
You'd have to undo it. You have to undo the business as best you can, to your best of your ability. Because you couldn't go to the company and say, look, through your takeover, I've lost money. Nothing to do with him.
Was switching from one stock to another something that you were doing fairly often as part of your business?
Switching I'm not quite sure.
Well, for example, selling one stock against.
Of an engineering stock or anything like that, you buy one and sell the other one as a gamble. They both go together. Yes, it would help your book occasionally to be short of one and long of the other.
Was there any particular skill or technique involved in that?
Your own ability, just your own ability, or your own way of thinking. It could be right to have one and lose the other one.
Did price agreements ever come into your jobbing experience?
No, we wouldn't agree on it. There were times that other jobbers said, look, we would like to make a closer price or a wider price, and we said no.
What were the reasons for that?
The reason we were given that we didn't agree that there should be a fixed price because it wasn't fair to clients. It wasn't fair to brokers or clients to have a fixed agreement. We were asked several times about it, couldn't do anything.
How did that affect Smith's popularity with other firms? Did they tend to accept it?
They accepted it. There could be one or two people who turned on a bit of a black face, you know, a bit of a grievance, but we were bigger than most firms, and if Durlach and ourselves didn't agree upon it, then you might as well say it finished, fait accompli.
Going back to this typical day I asked you about earlier, did you stop for lunch at some stage during trading?
Well, yes, but I mean, generally we had our fixed lunches. If I went out, I left the book with my younger junior, or vice versa, see. But I always took it about 1 o'clock, because that's when the markets in the suburbs were closed. And most people went for lunch at 1 o'clock. I generally went from 1 to 2 years.
What did you do for lunch? Did you go back to the office?
No, just go and have a sandwich over at Slater's or Birch's in those days. You probably don't know this place, do you? Slater's and Birch's. Well, all the jobbers went over there and had coffees together or drink scotch or beer. The long room, yeah.
Did you have much contact with other jobbers outside of your firm?
Oh, yes. I think it was quite a good affinity of a job. Yes, you were very nice to each other. As I say, you could undo each. The smaller jobbers always came to me and undid a lot of business. I dealt with Wed sometimes, if it suited me. You knew the partners well. We had lunches together. There was a goodwill, very goodwill built up, but not no animosity at all. Mm.